Well, it's a little after 4, and so since we really need to be out of here by 5 to, for the going away party in the dining hall, I think we better get started. And for the tape, I am Tom Pearson, and this is the session, Global Climate Change, Is It Real? So let me start by saying, first of all, that I am not an expert on global climate change. But I did want to raise this issue because global climate change and the controversy surrounding it is something that we are dealing with not just this issue, this one issue, but a number of different issues that have a scientific or technological basis that are very much in the forefront of the news and are issues that really we as the residents of Earth and as informed citizens who are voting for people to make decisions for us in this country, we need to be aware of these things and we need to be well equipped to filter out a barrage of information that's coming at us from many, many different sources. And I'll say from the outset, some of that information is going to be reliable and some of it is not. And so what I'd like to do is talk about some of the sort of best understanding we have of the climate change issue right now, but also talk about the scientific process, because that's something we all know something about, and I want to emphasize how to think scientifically in ways so that we as citizens can make better informed decisions about some of this stuff. My background is I'm a geologist. I work on volcanoes. I work at the Cascades Volcano Observatory for the USGS, and we monitor volcanoes throughout the Cascades and also work on scientific studies in a number of different countries around the world. So I'm coming at this as a scientist, and we'll try to convey some of my perspectives on the issue from that point of view. As I said, there are a number of different really important issues facing us. We're going to have to deal with the questions of alternative energy sources here, and that's a big one. We're going to need to deal with more with pollution and what we do about that. And all of these are very complex issues. Another is GMOs, genetically modified organisms, that we are releasing into ecosystems around the world. None of these are simple, they're all complex. Coming up with solutions will require trade-offs. There are no perfect solutions for any of these things. So to get things started on how we look at this, I'd like to open it up to you guys and to see kind of some of your perspectives on this one issue, on global climate change. What do you see as believable and not believable in what's out there in the press? What information sources do you trust? And why do you trust those particular information sources? And do you think that scientists are pushing an agenda on this? Yeah. So I toss it out there. What are some of your thoughts, Walter?
I saw in the Nature Conservancy the phrase, the trees, the forests are the lungs of the earth. And I see regularly that trees make oxygen. And that's perfectly true, but it's never mentioned that when the tree dies and returns to the soil, that every last bit of that oxygen is taken back up again and all of the carbon dioxide is released to the atmosphere. It's a big net zero.
With some time lags.
With time lags,
in,
yes.
In there. That's true. That's true. So there's an issue where one side of the story is promoted pretty heavily, and maybe not the other side. The other half has not, not gotten out there. That's a good point. Yeah.
My most of my information about global warming that has any numbers on it is related to the movie Inconvenient Truth, and I hope that that was mostly true, because that's it looked believable to me, and I kind of bought it. So, but I have some young Republican acquaintances who tell me that it's a crock, and that global warming is really a joke, but it is the biggest hoax ever. And I think, well, people thought the world was flat too, and that global warming doesn't look remotely like a hoax to me. With the, I've seen other scientific numbers, but that's where the whole thing was wrapped up pretty well and presented. I'm thinking, what part of that could have been manufactured? And there are people who are still calling it a hoax that don't even say that those numbers aren't true, so I still don't know how they're getting that that global warming isn't happening. I haven't heard the arguments about why it is some people think that global warming is a hoax. I don't understand where that side of things is coming from.
Yeah, and definitely there are people who truly believe in good faith that this is a hoax that is being perpetrated for political reasons.
We have a large wetlands near us, and there's this big sign and a diagram on the wetlands are the kidneys of the earth that keeps the water clean. It goes through the different levels, and yet you turn around and hear all the efforts that are made to save them against people that want to build on them. And, you know, it seems like a lot of those they end up losing. Well, there's pollution again in another form.
And it's generally true that business interests with a lot of money can exert a lot of political pressure to accomplish certain development tasks in areas, usually for profit that may not be in the best interest of a community.
That's right.
Yeah. You have a point?
Oh, you asked about our sources of information. I mean, I've read a lot of articles. The two most recent books I've read is Elizabeth Kolber's book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, which is kind of a visiting various places around the world where there is evidence of climate change, and Bill McKibben's most recent book called Earth with Two A's. And I find these to be convincing. They seem like thoughtful, intelligent people, and they have done surveys of, you know, basically a lot of the science that has been done. And Colbert's made, one of the points that she made was, and on this issue, all the scientists she's talked to are way more concerned than the general public, and it's usually the other way around. I've come across other books written by, well, that report research from University of Washington atmospheric science professors that are just horrifying. I mean, about, you know, as the level of carbon dioxide goes up, you know, all the things that are going to happen to all the ecosystems. I find this convincing.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just point out that a lot of people who write books will cite credible sources, and maybe even cite actual true references. And not always report accurately what is in those references. And that does happen. I think maybe one truism is that once an issue gets out there and people start writing books about it from whichever political perspective, they're going to start cherry-picking facts and studies to support their viewpoint. So I think for one thing it's important to read a number, check a number of different sources. And then check on the ones that as best you can determine are mainstream. And are truly representing a majority view of capable scientists. And I'll say on this one issue, there are capable scientists who do not believe global warming is as bad or is as much the fault of human activity as the majority do. But as I'll come around in the end of this, an overwhelming majority of climate scientists now do believe that even though there are natural causes and natural cycles in climate, our activity as human beings on Earth is an overwhelming influence on these natural cycles and is pushing things in a certain direction. So let's get into that. Those are great observations, great comments. Let me back up a little bit and talk about the process of doing science. Okay, now as I said, I don't do this myself for climate issues or atmospheric issues, but I do it for volcanoes and volcanic hazards and things like that. And I think there's a lot of misconception out in the general public about what science is and what scientists can do and do when they do their work. And I think some people put more credence into the scientific effort than is warranted in some cases. And I'm going to throw out a few questions here for you and see what you think. And you don't have to answer right now because we'll come back to them in the end. One is, do you think something can be scientifically proved? Can we prove something scientifically? So think about that one. If something is just a theory, like the theory of evolution, is it therefore not true because it's only a theory? Another is there such a thing as an absolute scientific truth? So we'll kind of come back around to that. And understanding how science works is really important because of these kinds of environmental questions, things that affect social welfare policy, economic policy in our country and countries all over the world. And also for all of us as consumers, we are bombarded with information that tells us that something is true about a certain product, and they claim scientific evidence to back up their point of view, but sometimes it's worth looking into those claims a little bit. Basically, what is science? Science is an activity that's carried out, a systematic activity that's carried out to acquire reliable but not infallible information and knowledge about the physical world and how to explain how it works. And the emphasis here is that science is an ongoing process. We never really get to an end point when we're doing science, because there's always more data out there. There's always more evidence that may change the general view of how things work. It's never over. Yeah.
How are you differentiating between data and information?
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about that right here. Yeah, good point. Science involves two things. It involves, quote, facts or empirical data. And by that, I mean observations or measurements that we make on or about something in the natural world. And it's important to emphasize that we can never measure anything perfectly. And there's always error involved in measurements. And both in the actual trying to measure it, but also in the statistical or the probabilistic reality of how things work, there are often exceptions to any rule that we think we're seeing when we make measurements. The other thing that science involves, in addition to data, scientific data or empirical data, is thought. We think about this. We use logic to analyze and to try to make sense out of the observations and measurements that we find. And then, actually, I said there's two. Actually, there's a third, and that is using models. And models are simplified systems, and usually represented in mathematical form, that try to capture the essence of how something works. Maybe a very simple explanation of that might be, okay, a farmer needs to know how much water one of those circular irrigation systems is providing to his field. And so he uses an equation, a simple formulation that would say take the area of the air of the thing being sprinkled, the field being sprinkled, and the flow rate of water coming out, and then the amount of time the sprinkler is on. And he can, with that mathematical representation of a physical process, can come up with an answer that he needs. And that's what mathematical models do. They are oversimplified in terms of what reality really is. And it's especially true when we talk about climate models, because climate models are a series of mathematical equations that climate scientists use to try to represent what's happening, interactions between the Earth and the ocean and the atmosphere, and the transfer of heat and energy back and forth, and under what conditions clouds form, and where the wind is blowing, and where it's going to rain and where it's not going to rain. That can all be reduced to mathematical equations. And in a system as complex as climate and weather, they're pretty complex equations. And they're always evolving. Somebody's coming up with better ideas about how that system works. But it's a simplified representation of a very complex natural system. And we can use those models to test what we observe, and also to try to make predictions about what's going to happen in the future. And these kinds of models play a really important part in what scientists are concluding about what's happening with climate in the world. And I should also back up to say the difference between climate and weather is that weather is happening right now in terms of rain and temperature and that sort of thing. Climate is the long-term patterns of temperature, weather, heat flow, and heat exchange that is happening on the Earth's surface, and how it affects precipitation patterns, storms, and that sort of thing over long periods of time. So I think whether we realize it or not, we all use a scientific method often when we solve problems, and they can be fairly simple problems. Let's say you come home one night after eating out in town, come back to your house, you open the door, you flip on the switch to the light in your living room, and nothing happens. The light does not go on. Well, there's an issue there that you actually will use a kind of a modified scientific method to try to solve that problem. First of all, you're going to identify what the problem is, and that's what scientists do. Okay, what problem are we going to study here? What are the boundaries of the problem? And in this case, the problem is my light doesn't go on, and I don't know why. And then you're going to probably develop some hypotheses about why that is the case. And a hypothesis is a possible explanation for a physical event or occurrence. And so in the case of coming home, you say, well, that particular light bulb might be burned out, or the circuit breaker might have flipped in the in the box. If we want to be a little more dramatic, we could think, well, maybe an intruder broke into the house and has cut the power, and he's hiding behind the couch waiting to jump out when I walk in. Maybe the power company had a blackout, and so nobody has power. So you're going to design a study and to figure out what this is. And what you're going to do is you're going to start testing your different hypotheses with data that you're going to collect. So maybe the first thing to do is you go in and you take a light bulb out of another lamp, put it in the one that doesn't go on, and see now, does it go on or not? Well, you might, or the next thing you might do is go to your breaker box and see if all the breakers are in the right position, or if one is flipped over to the other side. And there's a number of things you're going to do. You just look outside. Are all the lights, are the street lights on in the street? Are other people's lights on in the neighborhood? And so these are all ways of collecting data. And by collecting that data and analyzing it and thinking about it, you're using logic, you're going to come up with an answer. And you're going to solve the problem, and you're going to come to a conclusion. And that conclusion, in scientific terms, is a theory. And what's the difference between a hypothesis and a theory is a hypothesis is an idea you have about how something works that hasn't been tested. You haven't tested that idea. A theory is the same thing. It's an explanation, but that you have tested. You've gone out and collected data. You've tried it out. You see if logic holds up and that explanation makes sense. And the key thing with the scientific process is there's always more data out there. And any scientist or group of scientists can only collect so much. One often used example is for a hypothesis is all swans are white. And you can send out biologists all over the world and study swans, and by golly, everyone they see is white. Everyone they see is white. They keep collecting data from country to country to country. But in fact, in a few places, swans are black. There are black swans. So the hypothesis is supported so long as the data is supporting it, and it's really just you have a tentative conclusion, and you have a theory. It's supported by data. But there's always that possibility that you're going to find some data, some observations, some measurements that disprove that explanation. And so that's kind of why the process is never over. When we test a hypothesis many, many times and it holds true, we call it a theory. And if it's tested infinitely many more times, and it still holds true, it becomes a scientific law. And yet, even though it becomes a scientific law, it's still not cast in concrete. Newton developed laws of motion about how physical objects moved under the influence of gravity and force in on Earth. And that worked great until scientists started looking smaller and smaller at particles in subatomic particle size range, and lo and behold, not everything obeys Newton's laws of motion. And Einstein's theory of relativity and quantum mechanics starts kicking in. There's a whole other way of thinking about how things move. Even though this stuff was a scientific law, it was disproved in that one particular case, so it doesn't always work. There are statements made, and some of these will be in commercials you'll see on TV. Something like antibiotics are effective in fighting infections. Now that's a very general statement, but it is a scientific statement because it is testable, and that's the key. If we can go out and test it, if we can collect data, if we can make measurements to see if it's right or not, that becomes a testable scientific statement. And in that statement, antibiotics are effective in fighting infections. Well, some are and some aren't. You know, there are some superbugs where certain antibiotics won't kill them. And in other cases, there are. So the more specific you can make a scientific statement, the more you can narrow the confines of what your problem is and identifying your problem, the greater success you're going to have in actually coming up with a valid conclusion. And the other thing, I already mentioned this. Your scientific statements may be wrong, and probability is going to be an important thing. 99% of the time, or greater, something might be true. But there's always the chance that a fraction of 1% of the time, there'll be some series of combination of variables that can cause it not to be true. Natural systems are very complex. There are many variables at play. And in a lot of cases, they tend to be fairly similar most of the time, but not always. So probability is an important thing. And as I said before, there's going to be always error in your data from various sources. And let me also explain how the process goes, how scientists then proceed. Once they've done a study, they're going to write it up. Scientists do their science by writing a paper for a technical journal, a scientific journal somewhere in their field of expertise. And basically what they do is they go through those steps. They identify the problem, they say how they collected the data, they say what thought process they used to come up with their conclusions. They say then, okay, my hypothesis was this, my data shows that this held true, so my conclusion, my tested conclusion is thus. And I write a paper. And I then start a process, which is kind of a validation process for science that exists within the scientific community everywhere. And so what I do, and people in my agency, but virtually everybody else does the same thing, I write a manuscript and I send it out to some colleagues. Now this is going to be an unofficial review. My agency requires it. Universities may not require it, other agencies may not, but it's required for me. So I send it to my colleagues, and I send it to people who are experts in that field. And I ask them to review it. And what they do is they go through the whole thing. They go through how I collected the data, how I identified the problem, how I collected the data, whether I collected the right data, did I make valid conclusions about the data in my logical analysis of that. Does the data support my conclusions? And sometimes I'll get a paper back and say, "Oh, Pearson, what were you thinking? Your data doesn't even support that. You're grasping for straws here on this point. This is speculation. It's not supported here." Okay, so then I need to go back and rewrite my paper, maybe collect some more data, maybe think about it some more, and maybe come to a different conclusion based on that data. Okay, I revise the paper, and then I have to go through an approval process. There's another review layer in my agency, one more level of quality control. I then submit it to a journal, and the journal then does the same thing, and they'll send that paper out to experts in the field, maybe some guy in France and maybe some guy in New Zealand who are also experts in this, and they will do the exact same thing. Even though I think I fixed the problems, I usually find out that they find a few more that I need to fix and other things that aren't quite supported. The journal will say, okay, we're not even going to publish this until you address these issues. So I have to address them or it doesn't get published. And once I do address them, once it gets published out there, it's out there in the scientific community. You know, it seems like I'd be able to take a deep sigh of relief and say, okay, it's done. It's it's out there, and it's part of our scientific understanding of how the world works. But there can be some guy somewhere who does another experiment, and he comes up with a different conclusion. And maybe he looked at some aspect of the problem that I didn't even consider. And then he'll write a paper. And in his paper, he'll say, hopefully politely and without making me feel too stupid, he'll say, well, this, you know, the work that Pearson did was good up to this point, but he didn't consider this, this, and this. And so the whole scientific enterprise is this ongoing writing of papers and people reading them and evaluating them, people who have expertise. And this is not necessarily a lot of people. This might be just 2 or 3 dozen people in the world that are really intimate with these one particular narrow topic. But I can tell you they give it a good check over. And there are always new graduate students coming up who might have an idea about how something might be slightly different than the accepted way that we understand things. And it's an ongoing process, so it's never, never over. And so I would say that that statement I raised earlier, can you say something is provable scientifically? How did I say it? Is there such a thing as absolute scientific truth? No, there's not. But what there is a general understanding of how things work that has been vetted by a large number of very smart people who are thinking about it very hard. And to the best of all our collective abilities, we come to a conclusion that this is the best explanation right now of how something works. So in climate change issues, there is a tremendous number of people, very smart people, who have been thinking about this for a couple of decades now. They've been collecting a lot of data. And the overwhelming majority of climate scientists have come to the conclusion that, indeed, although there are natural causes for climate cycles and changes in climate, that indeed human beings, and especially in the production of excessive amounts of carbon dioxide and methane, are affecting our climate, and they're affecting it in a way that is going to be causing some really big changes and are going to be really hard for our civilization to deal with. So do you have any questions right now about that? I want to say.
Well, just from a method point of view, I thought you brought up an interesting example with the antibiotics. So because that's a marketer in between the science and the population. And with the scientific community, you've got researchers, and I'm assuming these aren't qualitative researchers because you can't go out and do an ethnographic methodology on, you know, a glacier or something. So this is hard, raw data that you're dealing with. And I'm wondering if you think these are good storytellers for the population, or whether there are another set of storytellers between the science and the population.
Well, there is a whole field out there that we tend to call pseudoscience. And that's people who have an agenda that they want to push, usually for political reasons, and they will dress it up in scientific terminology. And they'll write books, and they'll be very convincing books. But the scientific understructure, the foundation based on good scientific studies, is not there. And what they try to do is convince the reader from sort of a common sense or logic point of view that their viewpoint is right. For example, and this is one that just came out and was addressed by a colleague of mine in the volcano business, and it has to do with climate change. And somebody wrote a book that came out recently and basically said volcanoes produce a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide. And in fact, they do. During a single eruption of one volcano, up to 10 or even 15,000 tons of carbon dioxide can be released during an eruption by that volcano, and that's per day. 10 to 15,000 tons of CO2 per day going into the atmosphere. And so he says, well, we've got lots of volcanoes, and we do, and there are hundreds of them around the world. 50 or 60 of them are erupting on any given day. He says, it's a no-brainer. There's so many volcanoes putting all this stuff. It has to be way more than all the cars and trucks and factories are putting out. In making his argument, he was appealing to kind of a common sense and also
logic
and logic and also failing to provide accurate data on what the cars and trucks and factories are actually putting out. And so my geologist colleague got in there and replied to him and so what he found out. So I get the numbers right here, this paper was published just last month. Present-day emissions from all the volcanoes in the world varies between 150 million and 270 million metric tons of carbon dioxide per year. Sounds like a huge number. It is a huge number. It's an amazing amount of stuff. But, in fact, human emissions from fossil fuel burning, cement production, gas flaring, and land use changes has to do with manipulating vegetation and altering the balance between the amount of CO2 that can be absorbed by certain types of vegetation and what can't, and what's being stored in the biomass that's there in the plants. Add all of that together. In a year, these produce 36,300 million metric tons of CO2. So it's about 130 times more CO2 than the volcanoes. And he went to great lengths to cite his sources, and he used very reliable sources. And so that was, you know, one case of addressing, you know, somebody who was out writing a book trying to discredit climate science and not using real scientific data to do it, or at least using what he selected but not giving the complete picture.
But didn't your scientist actually kind of almost skew the facts in a different way? Because he used four different components. He used car emissions.
Mm-hmm.
What were the other three?
Cement production, because what you're doing is you're cooking limestone and you're producing CO2 as a byproduct.
And what were the other two?
Gas flaring, oil well production.
Uh-huh.
They burn gas.
Okay. And
land use changes. And that's not a complete list. That was
right.
Those were data that were available.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of people, the last three, or two of the last three, the cement and the land use, are not figures that people are common with and are familiar with. And be curious, I mean, if you just highlighted the transportation use, and even if the transportation use was even, that would have negated his point. So it's almost like it appeared like your scientist went overboard to substantiate a point when he could have said, well, there are 20 different things, and here's one, and it knocked it out.
Well,
that's
true. And it is, how you present the data is important. And in this particular paper, I'm just summarizing. He went and he gave the actual number for cars and trucks and vehicles around the world, and each of these separately, and then added them together. Because
mm-hmm.
what we're, in this case, the point he was trying to make is the human impact on climate. And he took what he considered to be the four most important ones. And I forget how the other guy actually framed it, but he was addressing that other guy's claims point by point in his paper.
I think it's important to point out, too, that all scientific journals are not peer-reviewed. So many articles that are published in science magazines or journals are just the author's ideas, and nobody has looked at it or agreed with it or anything, whereas peer-reviewed journals are the ultimate source.
That is an excellent, excellent point, and very true. And there are political entities, people with political points to make, who actually publish journals and make them look very much like the regular scientific journals. And so that's true. What you have to do in checking is this a peer-reviewed journal or not? And there are lists out there of which ones are and which ones aren't. So important.
We hear little bits and pieces about different things that the car manufacturers are doing. That's just one of the things. And with just recycling and all that, is there any data out that there's any progress in the right direction, even if it's just a pinpoint? Or is it going backwards?
Well, I can't answer. There's a huge amount of data out there, and the more the better. The more we can collect, the better understanding we'll have, and so it's how we evaluate that data. And so that, and so let me come now to sort of a summary of some of the impacts of global climate change as evaluated by the national academies, the National Academy of Science, which is a government agency or sort of a government panel, really, of the smartest people in the various scientific fields that they put together. And the U.S. National Academy of Science, and we also have one for medicine, and there's a third I'm blanking on right now. But these guys are brought together by the government to evaluate what's out there and say, okay, what is the good science here? What's the takeaway message we need to focus on? And so their summary here, and let me just hit the highlights, and you can find this information in a number of different places. Like I said before, there are lots of natural reasons for climate to change. The input of solar energy varies. There are shifts in the Earth's crust, so plates are moving around, and that affects ocean circulation patterns of how ocean currents circulate. And the ocean is hugely important in climate because it's such an absorber and releaser of heat in the water. Volcanic activity, glaciers, vegetation, and of course human activity. The Earth's rotation and orbit around the Sun varies in cycles. The Sun's energy output varies cyclically. There are a number of different things that can vary and are recognized. And some of these changes, some of these natural changes, can cause feedback that can push things even further. For example, if glaciers start to disappear, which they are in many parts of the world right now, we're not only losing that ice volume, but we're also losing something called albedo. Albedo is the reflectivity of the Earth's surface. So if you have a nice white ice sheet, it's going to reflect a lot of the solar radiation back into space. You get rid of that, the Earth is actually able to absorb more heat. And so glaciers are getting smaller, but we're also losing some ability to reflect the energy back. So we're absorbing more energy from the Sun, so it's kind of feeding on itself and pushing it in one direction. And so there are a lot of these kind of complicated feedbacks. About oceans, well, water vapor, CO2, and methane trap heat in the atmosphere, and you're probably all familiar with this, like a greenhouse. A greenhouse works by letting a lot of solar radiation in through the glass, but only some of the radiation can escape back out through the glass because of a change in the wavelength of the re-radiated energy going out. And so what you then have is a gradual buildup of heat due to the fact that this glass is acting as a filter and then as a reflector for some of this energy. Carbon dioxide and methane do the same thing, and methane is about 25 times more effective in trapping heat than CO2. Let's see, no, I think I actually got that wrong. Yes, methane. Okay, methane, yeah, is about 25% more effective in trapping heat. And
25 times or 25%?
25%. I said times, didn't I? 25% more effective. The oceans are really important. They absorb a lot of solar energy, and they distribute it around the world. Ocean currents are being affected by the changes in polar ice caps because that cold water melting and draining into the oceans is causing currents to get redirected. The level of CO2 in the atmosphere is higher than it's been in a very long time on Earth. I tried to verify this number and couldn't re-find the source, but as I recall it, it's as high as it's been in about 500,000 years. And by the way, my source for this is a U.S. Global Change research program, which is also supported by the American U.S. National Academy of Science. The CO2 level in the atmosphere now is 35% higher than it was in 1850 when the Industrial Revolution really got going. CO2 level now is about 380 parts per million, and it was between 260 and 280 parts per million for about 10,000 years before 1850. Methane is about 150% higher now than in 1850. During the 20th century, globally average surface temperature rose by just slightly more than 1 degree Fahrenheit. Doesn't sound like much, but it doesn't take real big changes in average temperature to cause pretty dramatic changes in some parts of the Earth. Since 2000, the year 2000, it's increased by another quarter of 1 degree. Geologic evidence from tree rings and ice cores and sedimentary layers and even historic records are the way that we can get back at seeing what climate had been doing over the past many thousands of years. And the conclusion of climate science is that the natural processes that are occurring just can't explain this much change this fast. What's going to happen in the future? There are many things, and here, let me just pass these out. I focused on one for you to take home with you, and that's some of the effect on water and water supply on the Earth. And this is from a summary article in National Geographic magazine on what's happening to water. The take-home message, though, for this is that As the average temperature of the surface warms, what's going to happen is that, first of all, we're going to get a rising sea level. And also let me say that the models that the climate scientists are using now, the best ones that are available, and they're different. They don't all reach exactly the same conclusion in their projections, but they all do predict an increase in temperature in this century. So when we look to the year 2100, they're predicting between about 4.5 and 11.5 degrees of increase. The last time the Earth was that warm was during the Pliocene epoch, about 3 million years ago. And back then, sea level was 25 meters, about 75, 80 feet higher than it is now. There was no Florida back then. It was totally submerged. You know, sea level, you know, 75 feet of sea level rise would submerge most coastal cities in the world. There's a huge implications of that sort of thing. The Pliocene climate was different in some ways from the way things are evolving now, so it might not necessarily be quite that bad, but sea level rise is big. And you may have heard in the news, some oceanic countries that are out in the middle of the Pacific are actually having to abandon their islands because of sea level rise. And the storms are sweeping waves right over the islands now. It's going to have a drastic effect on the supply of fresh water in many parts of the world, particularly those places where water is in short supply now, places like India and Pakistan and sub-Saharan Africa. And some of the information is on the sheet. Lots of people think, and I think their arguments are really worth paying attention to, that some of the biggest security threats that we're facing in this world are going to be conflicts that are going to be arising over the availability of water. That there are going to be millions and millions of people that just won't be able to get it, and they're going to be desperate. And so.
Well, I think there's a whole other issue, and that is that we've allowed large companies, and in Michigan they allowed a company to take, I think it's 100 million gallons out of the aquifer every day for bottled water.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, nobody, there wasn't enough of a fuss put up, let's put it that way. And they don't pay for that, per se.
Yeah.
They've got a free access.
Well, we're not feeling the pinch all that much here yet in this country, and some of the statistics in that sheet show it. You know, in the developing world, the water is a lot more scarce than it is for us here in this country, at least most places in this country.
Tom?
Yes?
I liked your albedo comment. I think that's right, the feedback, the solar radiation coming in, and worsening because of the loss of ice. I think the same thing happens with tundra too, is that thaws, it begins to decompose.
Yes.
And puts out carbon dioxide, and that's not really reversible.
Right.
There was an article about a year ago by Bill McKibben, you probably know that name, in National Geographic, and he said that we're going to reach a tipping point in about 34 years. And if we come to that point without having done anything effective, that the changes will be taking place far faster than we can ever do anything about it.
Yeah.
And in so many words, it'll be all over. Do you have other comments on that?
Well, at this point, I was going to basically turn it over to looking at the question, okay, what do we do? Some practical solutions, but not total solutions, are that we can stop or drastically reduce the amount of deforestation we do, because trees are very effective in grabbing carbon and keeping it in biomass for long periods of time. We can try to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and you know that's a really politically hot topic right now. We can try to start coming up with technological solutions where we sequester carbon, like underground, or we plant more forests, or grasslands, and other things we can do is reduce our vulnerability. If people are living in places that are vulnerable to some of these changes, let's maybe start trying to get people moved out of those vulnerable areas and into more sustainable areas. I mean, there are some things we can do, but I agree, these problems are going to be huge, and they're going to be coming at us so very fast that it's going to be really hard to react. So I believe this is a moral issue for us as people of faith, but it's also very much a political issue. And the answers aren't easy. There are trade-offs. We might have to give up some stuff we really value in order to get at solutions that are going to be the best for the greatest majority of people. And so my plea to you is to educate yourselves, continue to educate yourselves, because clearly you guys know a lot about this. And so that together we can start making some tough decisions and elect officials and leaders in government who will move us in directions that are good. Yeah.
You referred to some people having the perspective that climate change is a hoax, and other people thinking that climate change scientists have a political agenda. I'd enjoy hearing your perspective on either side. What would the agenda be? Like, if climatologists are making it up, why would they be doing that? And on the other hand, people who are doing pseudoscience, what's your perspective on why they're doing it? Like, what is it, a certain kind of fundamentalism? Is it in the interest of the corporate elite? I mean, what's your perspective on what would be the motivating on either side for making it up?
What? My simplest answer would be people are very reluctant to change and change the way we do things. And there can be a host of reasons why change is not good for some people. And one would be if people make a lot of money doing things a certain way and you say you can't do that anymore, there's going to be pushback from that, definitely. And that's one of them. But there are many reasons why people don't want to hear the message.
I think another is fear.
Good one.
It's just fear of the unknown. You want me to go ahead and do something different, but you can't tell me what different's going to look like. Okay? And if you can't give me a clear view of what different looks like, why the heck should I listen to you? I'm fine right now. You're full of BS. And I'm not saying you personally, I'm just saying and I'll use the utilities as an example. Okay, the utilities are, and I'm saying alternate energy and spend a little time focusing on the utilities, but the utilities are no different than IBM was in the 80s. IBM or anybody who dealt with the mainframe, they thought they were the gods of data, okay, because they had complete control. If you were in business and you wanted something, you had to go to the mainframe people and basically grovel to get what you wanted in a time frame that you wanted. And usually you were in a long queue, and if you were nice to them, you got it sooner than somebody else. But you usually didn't get it when you wanted it, okay? Then the PC industry came along, and I'm using this analogy. The PC industry came along, and PCs were available on somebody's desktop. And wow, an Excel spreadsheet came along, and somebody could go, wow, I can create these numbers on my desktop. I don't have to go to these people that are making my life difficult, right? And IBM stock went from 60 to 5. And they had to change how they did things. And that change was because they couldn't make money on mainframe anymore. The utilities are what's called a needed monopoly, and they've been defined as such. For a century, they've pretty much operated as a needed monopoly, which means everybody needs me to get going. There is some regulation at the state level and some regulation at the federal level, but everybody realizes they have to exist. Nobody's really questioned how they do business, all right? And now you have solar, wind, geothermal, methane, pick your ocean, take against coal and natural gas. And they're like, well, no, whatever you say is BS. And by the way, I hold all the numbers and I'm not going to share with you the numbers. So whatever you say, I will say no to and say, well, it's only 6 cents a kilowatt hour. But you don't have the full picture to compare that to know, well, is that because your plant is fully depreciated and so you have all you have is maintenance costs? Or, you don't know what it's based on. And so that's really the question. And when you brought up the point of, well, we could do all these other things, well, in the United States, we could do what Europe's been doing for 20 years, which is to put in passive homes. In Europe, they can pay 75 euros a year for the utilities. There are very few houses in the United States where you could do that. And the McKinsey Consulting Organization in 2007 did a study that said the fastest way for us to reduce our carbon footprint was to retrofit, what's called a deep retrofit, every home, so that our utilities would drop. Because the other thing about the utility industry is that they have to design their systems for absolute peak use. You know, the hottest summer day or the coldest winter day. And all of their systems have to be designed to handle that. So, there's my two cents.
That's a very good point. And solutions are complex, but...
They are.
They're possible. But all of our input is needed in this, and we've got a job to do, so... Go forth and do it. Thank you.
Thank you.